This is an interview with Earl D. Butler for the California State College Bakersfield, California Odyssey Project by Judith Gannon at Lindsay, California on February the 3rd, 1981 at 1 o'clock 8 p.m. Why don't we begin with your telling me a little bit about your childhood in Missouri, and then we'll just kind of work forward. Just go along and recollect if you can.
Well, my recollection's not really that good, but I remember that we lived out near the woods in a small place, we always lived in old, well, they were big, but they were old houses, and there were six of us kids, and we grew vegetables, had beef, had pigs, chickens, workhorses, and stuff like that. And then I remember my dad, my older brother, hunting and small traps and stuff like that. And one thing that I always remember is when they would butcher the pigs and they'd boil the water outside and scalding water and so forth and hang them up. I remember an awful lot of snakes. Seemed like every type and every variety. And also remember, and even though I don't know exactly how it works now, it seemed like every place had a smokehouse and where they kept their meat and so forth, and there were no refrigerators.
And your dad was a small farmer in Missouri?
Yes.
Did he own his own farm, or did he?
I think all of them that yes, he owned was buying, and most of the time would lose in the process if they had a bad year. But even though we were poor, we always had good food and lots of food. Maybe not the type that we wanted. At that time, I recall my mother always made bread, something that you'd like now. Then, well, he would have given anything to have bought in bread. And then probably when it was about six or seven, we moved to town, to a place called El Dorado Springs, Missouri. And we lived right in town. It changed our lives from what we were. Of course, at that time, the Depression was on and nobody had any money anyway. But I remember one incident that we charged stuff at the grocery store. I think at that time, my father came out here ahead of the rest of us, and I suppose to find work, maybe to make some money and then send for the family. But anyway, well, we had this charge account at the store. Another boy and I went, charged 11 cents worth of candy, and it bought a lot. And the grocer kind of looked at me funny, and he said, "Are you sure your mother said this is all right?" I said, "Yes." So anyway, it wasn't. It turned out bad, but other than that, it seemed like that school, whereas in the country, we went to a one-room schoolhouse and all, I think, grades 1 through 8, so forth. We used to walk in the snow and walk no matter what the weather was. In town, well, it was a much larger school. I forget how big it was, and it was different. And you got into more of a difference of kids or different kinds of people, and possibly a little more trouble to get into living in town versus living in the country. And other than that, don't know. I can't recall anything right now, Judy.
What brought about the move to town?
I don't really know. Probably because he couldn't make the payments on the place. And I know out when we lived in the country, Dad would farm with a horse and a plow and so forth, and it's what I guess it would be what you call river bottom land. And also remember when we lived there too that they would put these big fish baskets in the river or creek. They call everything creeks back there, I think. We had lots of fish too. Probably catfish. I don't know, catfish and perch. I don't know what is back there, and one thing I remember that, and I still like to this day a lot, is good pork chops. And back there, even though we were dirt poor, had no clothes or very very few clothes, we had the tenderloin of pork and which would be better than any that you got out here. Plus you had your own butter, you had your eggs and stuff like that. You just had no money. One thing, and I remember, and like I say, we were dirt poor. And one Christmas, I think I was 5 years old, and with six kids and no money, I can see where it would be really a problem at Christmas time. But my brother who was a little bit less than 8 years older than I was, at that time was probably about 13 or 14, and he worked and made his own money to buy a little metal car about 10 inches long that you pull and so forth. So he had just got that, and so Christmas morning, that was my only present. And so I thought, well, Santa had taken it from him and given it to me. So stuff like that, I mean, whether you'd be in Missouri or here or in that age or this age, you'd still remember, you know. And I remember also there that mostly kids played hide-and-go-seek. They looked for fireflies and stuff like that. And every place had a barn and had a hayloft and so forth. And usually the hens would run loose and nest in the mangers of the barn. I remember more than once coming out and seeing snakes eating the eggs and so forth. But there it's just a way of life. And I also remember the cyclones. And once you saw a cloud, you better head for the cellar, and you better head there fast. And most people or families would try to round up the horses and or cattle first, and chickens if possible, and get those in. But out here, if you see a cloud, well, it may deliver rain, it may not. You don't have that kind of worry. Another thing I recall, toy that we played with at that age was, I guess it would be the hoops off of wagon wheels. And even though most people may have had a Model T, or some of them, I guess, at that time had Model A's, most all of them had wagons and at least one or two horses to pull the wagon with. But we would use a stick for a handle with a cross piece on it and roll those hoops all over the place. So
you said that when you moved to town, your father came to California at that time?
I don't recall if he came at that time. I don't think he came at that time, because I believe, I think when he went to town, somewhere in there, I don't know whether he was a World War I veteran, and whether he got some money through the service or as a bonus or what. I remember at that time the veterans were crying or organizing for a bonus, but whether it came through or not, I don't remember. But I believe when he went to town, and even though he wasn't educated, he went into real estate with somebody, and whatever money he had was soon gone. And we're right back where we started from. Not that it was that much to start with, if there was any at all. I just recall that he did go into real estate, which had been completely out of his line of work. And so we were probably in El Dorado Springs a year or less than 2 years, and somewhere during that time, I think possibly in January or February of that year, he came, which would have been 1937, he came back to California and back to Lindsay. And Lindsay was a place that he and my mother had lived before, and he had worked on a ranch. And then when my twin sister and I were born, or she was pregnant with us, well, then they decided to go back to Missouri again, and so that all the kids would be born there. And so he did know something about Lindsay, and they also had relatives here too.
So your father had, before your birth, he had come to Lindsay and worked here. Do you know what year that might have been?
Well, it would have had to been in 19, I don't know how long he was here, but all of us, all six of the children, that plus one that died at birth, were born in an 8-year span. So I would imagine it would have been in the year of 28, and probably went back in 1928, right before the crash. But at that time, when he was out here before, he worked for a man by the name of Mr. Crouch, and at that time had a new house furnished, a small house, and out east of town, and was, for the time, she was probably doing all right, you know. Mm-hmm. And but then he decided to go back and farm, which most at that time lots of people did. It seemed like they would come out here, then they couldn't break the ties that they had had, and they ended up going back. But when he did return this time, there was nothing. He picked fruit, and then I can't remember if it was a penny a box or 2 cents a box. And then we came out, I think it was in October of 1937. It was after school. The school year had already started. And I remember that we lived in an orange grove in a house that had an outside toilet and no running water. It was a small house with a big screened-in porch. It has since been torn down. And I don't know how many oranges that many kids could do away with, but it just seemed like it took forever and ever before you got your fill of oranges, because back there, the only thing you ever saw was on the market was a little small orange, probably a 180 size or even smaller, and you just craved oranges. So when we came out here, we would pick them by the sack full or box full and maybe do it two or three times in a day and eat all of them. So, like I say, I don't know how long it took before that many kids got their fill.
Your father was working then in the orange grove here in
He was working for a contractor, just as a picker, an orange picker. And then I remember that he would go out if they had and cut wood if they had decided to do away with a plum grove or a plum orchard or a peach orchard or whatever, or grape wood. He would, I think he had a trailer, then he had a saw, and then he had all of his kids with a crosscut saw, and he would I don't know what the deal was. I'm sure there was no money involved other than that he got the wood. And we would, as kids, had spent an awful lot of Saturdays cutting wood, two of us on the cross cut, and one of them, the little one usually, or my twin sister, sitting on top of to hold it down. But it wasn't, that wasn't the first place we moved. From the first place that we were at, then we moved about a half mile, and it also was a better house, no running water. And I think both places had electricity, but all of them were usually a one light deal in a room, and plus the fact with no money or lack of money, you had to watch how long you kept the light on. And it was really, it seems strange now, but at that time it wasn't that strange, because an awful lot of people were in the same fix. The people that, even as a kid, you could see the people that had a steady job, whether it was a good paying job or a fair paying job or whatever, if they had a steady income, they were doing good, you know. But the people that didn't, the people from the East, tended to stick together, and most of the time they would work together, get a job through one of their people that they knew. And so most of your association was with those people, or at least your folks' association.
When you came out to meet your father, did you come out by car? Did he come back and get you, or how did that take place?
We came out, the best I can remember, we came out in a 1929 Buick. They were a classy car in their day. This is 1937, and probably a gas heater, an oil burner too. I don't remember, but it had a luggage carrier or extension rack on the back, and I remember that was loaded down, and we probably had the mattresses like everybody else too, because but I can't really remember if we did or didn't, but I do remember that. I guess it was probably Route 66, the way everybody came. And I do remember that, seeing people along the road, and then usually when you stop at night, it wasn't in a motel, it was in a caravan, or even though we didn't come in a caravan, but you usually stop where other cars were stopped. And there was people all in the same boat, whether they were from Texas, Missouri, Oklahoma, or Arkansas. They were all headed for a better life, so to speak, and in most cases at that time, most of them would have probably been better off had they stayed put. But it was a case of go west, that the future was there, and work was plentiful, and the wages were good. Well, it wasn't that way when you got here. Plus the fact that if you'd lived in the country, you were poor, but you had some of your own food and so forth, and out here you didn't. And plus the fact that I think out here sometimes the people tended to, it would be similar to the way some of the wetbacks are treated now. There's somebody ready to relieve you of that dollar if you've got it. So, and most of these people were farm people anyway, didn't really know the ways of the world, so to speak. But anyway, I remember we would stop at night, and would have, I think we'd build a fire, so forth, and we were real crowded. So we must have slept outside on pallets, but I can't remember if we did or didn't. I do remember that at that time, I think they called it the SRA, and I think at that time I wasn't even familiar with canned much of canned foods because my mother canned and everything was in a jar, and the meat was fresher from the store, mostly from the smokehouse when we were in the country. But anyway, well, this SRA, which is a relief organization of some kind, had given us some apples, I think, and then some canned meat, which is probably roast beef. I got so tired of eating that, but that's all we had.
When was that? When you first got to Lindsay?
That was on our trip out here. This must have been from Missouri.
Oh, the SRA gave you.
And I think that's what they call it. Yeah, they so. They gave it because
Security Relief Administration, I think.
Probably
what,
so.
What that organization was. Do you remember how people got the idea that there were so many jobs in California?
I was small then, but all you could hear back there was that California was rich. I mean, you actually. It had so many things going for it, so to speak, and the work was plentiful. In fact, it's like any other thing. The word was that they're crying for help and stuff like that. Everybody was ready to make a move. And then, too, in all honesty, what they had there, if you're on the bottom and have nothing, you're more apt to pull up stakes and gamble and go elsewhere, because their thinking was it couldn't be any worse than what it was. Maybe it was, but so I mean, people I think all kind of had the attitude of what did they have to lose, and they might have something to gain by doing this. I remember my mother. Even with all those kids, worked as a dishwasher in a restaurant. I think this is after my dad came to California, and there they would whatever food was left over, they would let her bring home, and which really helped.
Mm-hmm. So, how long a period was it between the time that your father left to come to Lindsay and the family left?
I think it was probably from about 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure.
And how did you get the money together to make that trip?
I don't know whether he sent, whether he must have sent the money. And I remember my dad had been wounded in the service and got a $33 a month government pension check, and sometimes that was, well, that probably sustained us. And something I remember, and I can't recall, this is after I came out here, that probably in the fourth or fifth grade here in Lindsay Schools, and the teacher saying that this is what had to been. This is at the top of the Depression, I mean, at 38, 39, somewhere in there. But anyway, she was saying that a family couldn't get by on $125 a month, a family of four. And I was thinking to myself when she said, and my dad's $33 a month pension and his penny, maybe by then he was working in the packing house, but if he wasn't, it was probably at 25 cents an hour, 30 cents an hour. Anyway, $125 is more money than our family of eight, six children had. I remember that by quite a bit. And then I could also remember my dad and my uncle talking, and this is after they both worked in the packing house, and saying if they had if they were guaranteed $125 a month for the rest of their life, they could live good. So, you see how times have changed.
They sure have.
And since I've been grown, then I've heard people, in fact, I may have made this statement myself as a few years back, if I had $500 a month, I would feel like mm-hmm. have a good living for the rest of my life. I think it's just a statement of the times that you're in at that time.
You came to Lindsay because you had relatives here, is that what?
We had relatives here, and then we also probably, I don't know what brought my dad here to start with, but it was a logical place to return back to because he had ties where he had worked before. And I think probably when he came, he may have thought that he would get another job on a ranch. And when he had left, it was prior to the Depression. When he came back, it was in the middle of the Depression. In fact, probably 9 or 10 years later, and times had completely changed. So I think they came back to the place where they had been before.
Did your family stay right here in Lindsay and you worked the fruit around this area, or did the family follow the crops to?
He stayed here and worked, and then I remember when I was 14, which would have probably been 1943, he went to Sebastopol, which is about up by Santa Rosa, about 50 miles the other side of San Francisco, and worked in the packing house in the apples. And I think I went with him and also worked. And I remember at that time, it was after the war, and I don't care what people tell you, it wasn't until the war, they started gearing up for the war before times got better. I'm not so sure that they weren't sometimes getting worse there as the 30s rolled along. And I might also add that my dad hated President Roosevelt with a passion, and most of the people did, even though that he takes credit, Hoover gets all the blame for the Depression, and Roosevelt gets credit for the pulling it out.
Mm-hmm. You're not the first one that has said that.
Well, another thing too, I remember, this goes back here, I'm skipping from one place to the other, but when we're still out on the farm, that I don't know whether this is because some disease or something, there's such a disease as anthrax or something. Anyway, that they had to kill off lots of their cattle, or all of their cattle maybe, and they got a small subsidy from the government for it.
I've heard many people have told me about not the cattle were not diseased at all, but that the government policies were such at that time that they were trying to increase prices by killing, and also destroying crops. That there were places where the government would pay a small subsidy if the farmer would just kill his crops and not grow. They also got paid for not growing. Mm.
The first of subsidized farming, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it? Anyway, as I say, my dad wasn't a lover of President Roosevelt. I forgot, where was that out here then?
You had just gone to Sebastopol.
Okay. Prior to that, I think when I was 13 years old, I got a job in one time they were during school vacation or something here in a Lindsay packing house, and it seemed like it was 75 cents an hour. I can't remember, but it seemed, and I was going to school, but they needed somebody, and I think it was possibly because of the war being short on help. But anyway, it seemed like all kinds of money. And when I went to Sebastopol and worked there during the summer, and I remember we rented an apartment in Santa Rosa, which is 7 miles, and I think that was my first time ever out of this area. And we worked 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. I could make 90 cents an hour, $54 a week. And it just seemed like a fortune. Of course, I mean, at that age, you can get rid of it, too, and then I help pay expenses.
Okay, the alarm light is coming on, so just hold on for 1 second. I'll switch this over. Back to Sebastopol and 90 cents an hour for working in the packing house.
Well, I worked up there, and that was the first year that I started learning how to drive. And I think my dad at that time had an older car. It may have been a 29 or 30 Chevrolet or something. And I remember we were coming back from work. I think this is on a Saturday or a Sunday. And a busy two-lane highway, Highway 12. And my dad just pulled over to the side, and we had another friend of his with us that also worked there, and I think it stayed with us, and also from Missouri, and pulled over, and he said, "Okay, son, you drive." And that guy that was with him said, "I thought I was going to get killed, you know." So, but anyway, that was a pretty good summer for me. Prior to that, I'd done what yard work and stuff that I could do, and I remember anybody that needed any work, I think it was usually done at the rate of 25 cents an hour, like cleaning out chicken houses and stuff like that. Anything that you could do to earn a little bit.
Was the money that you earned like that summer, was that considered a part of the family income that you contributed, or was that your money that you were free to?
I think it was my money that I was free to do with. I think I paid a portion or maybe my share of expenses there, and the rest of it I had, and I remember I bought something for my mother. I think I may have bought her a watch or something because she hadn't had anything, and then I bought my own clothes and used it that way, but also had some spending money. I mean, it was to earn money for school clothes and stuff like that, but the rest of it was mine. And so anyway, that was in 1943, and I think it was February of 1944. Well, I came back and went, I think I rode the bus back when school started. My dad stayed up there, then came back to work in the citrus here, which usually starts in October, November. And then the next year, I believe it was in February of 44, my mother split up, and he went back to Missouri, and then supposedly, I think, on a visit, and ended up staying, and they got a divorce, and he remarried and lived back there till 1965 when he died. So it left my mother with no support. And at that time, we lived out in the country in it was a two-story house, and really quite an ugly house, but it was a big house, and there was four rooms upstairs. That summer, seemed like school had just finished, or so probably in June. And again here, I think they had water, running water inside, but an outside toilet. Had a barn, big barn, and which is always good for kids to play in. It wasn't stuck in an orange grove. It was in an orange grove, but it was right face the road, and so forth. But anyway, the house caught on fire and burned, and I remember that I was coming down the steps, and at that time my brother was in the service, and also I think I had two sisters married at that time. Both their husbands were in the service, and they had some of their clothes stored there, and then one of my sisters was pregnant that her husband was in the service, and she was just coming up the steps or something, she says, "I smell smoke." And I was just coming down. I don't even think I had a shirt on. And I remember we looked up and smoke was coming out of the middle part, and it burned all of the top story, and we had no phone. We had to go. I rode my bicycle down about a quarter of a mile to some people, and they called the fire department. And but it burnt the whole top story, and everything that I had was lost. I had a lot of these big little books and stuff like that, and really nothing else of any value, but they were all gone. And I think some of the stuff that most all the stuff we had upstairs was gone. The rest of the stuff down below, some of it was moved out, and just water damaged. And I remember that there was a Bible. I don't know whether it was one of the boys who were in the service or what, but it was on a shelf there in the room, and it was in a box, I believe, a cardboard box, and the cardboard box is singed somewhat and water drenched, but the Bible itself wasn't hurt. And so anyway, for a while we lived out in the yard, and then we moved to town, which was the first time I'd lived in town after we came to California. And as I say, I was 14, and my mother rented would be a duplex now. It was the biggest part of a house, and there was another apartment on one side. It was right downtown Lindsay almost. And so got my first taste of town living, which wasn't too bad. And she took to make a living. Well, for a while she used to stay at with people's kids at their house. And it was kind of a struggle because I think the welfare, and I can't remember, I don't remember if we got welfare or not, but anyway, well, I don't think we did. I think what they wanted to do, they wanted to put the minor children into foster homes, and she said no. And it's kind of something that at the time you don't appreciate until it's all over and done, and then you think, well. What a sacrifice. But anyway, she ended up babysitting, and then started to babysit in her house. And of course, his kids were in school. I think three of us were home. The rest of them were married. And the girl that was pregnant since moved to Colorado or somewhere with her husband. And so, but anyway, she babysat in her home, and then maybe it was a year or 2 years. At that time, there was all kinds of demand for it. You could babysit as many kids as you wanted to, I think. And there was lots of women that their husbands were in the service that were running around and so forth and want to leave their kids, and you might have them two or three nights. And anyway, she made enough money, and she didn't doing this, and then I would work after schools and so forth. But again, other than to buy my own clothes and stuff, and maybe help some, I didn't really contribute. And she paid down on a house. We lived on Elmwood Street, and it was down in a better neighborhood. And paid $3,000 for that house, and she was so proud of it. And because He paid $1,000 down, and somebody here in Lindsay, who I know now, carried the mortgage for $2,000. I forget what her payments were, but it seemed whoever had bought that house had paid $1,000 for it, and it sold it for $3,000. And I remember my mother, when she sold it, and I must have been 7 or 8 years later, she got $3,500 for it, and these people sold it and got probably $7,500, and now the house has a bunch of apartments behind it and so forth. But anyway, she was proud of that house. It didn't have the cement foundation. Of course, at that time, hardly any houses did. And it was 2 bedrooms, 1 bath, big living room, the old style living room and dining room combined, and kind of an archway in the middle, and screened in porch, and a kitchen with a lot of windows, and a big lot. And I think even at that time, when we first moved there, and I was sophomore, junior in high school, we had chickens in the backyard. And but anyway, she paid for that house, and I think before I was out of high school.
That's quite a tribute to that lady's money management to be able to babysit him.
Yeah, with many mouths to feed, it was. So, like I say, it's something that you don't truly appreciate until you become an adult yourself. Mm-hmm. So. At the time, I remember most of the time it was all right, but there were times that you were resentful of being poor. You were resentful of maybe you had a new couch and then some little kid would wet on it or this or that. And so I think probably all poor kids maybe go through a lot of that. I didn't go through a lot of it, but I did resent bringing people there. But you usually had kids all over the yard and other things too. But it was her way of making a living, the only way that she felt she knew how.
What did you do after you graduated from high school?
Well, let's see. Back to the Sebastopol thing. Even the rest of the time, I love that country up there, especially in the summertime. It's just a beautiful place. I went back. I'd got, as they say, fruit tramping. Well, I got my first taste of it. And so in the summertime, the work would usually start about the middle of July. So that would, then I'd have to be back by September, by Labor Day or a little bit after for school to start. And so I would go up and rent a room and work in the packing house and ride the bus. I didn't have a car, and ride the bus home. And so I did that. And even after I was married, I got married when I was 20, I did that for, I got married in 1949. And I did that for 2 or 3 more years. And after I got out of high school, I had worked, I had packing house experience, and I think the first job I had, I did whatever I could find to do to start with, and then in the packing house, titrated that first season in Citrus or Hillside Packing here in Lindsay, and that's where you test the sugar acid ratio, and then went from that to other things. And I think when I was 18, this friend of mine and I, he had been in the Merchant Marine, and he said, let's get a job picking olives. So we threw more olives and we picked, and we worked about a day or two at that, and he said, oh, heck, says, let's go get a job at the Lindsay Olive Plant. So it was the first time, I think maybe I'd been in it once before when I was in grade school, a tour or something. So we went over and signed up, and it just so happened it was in October, and when they needed help and so forth, and I think we were hired either on the spot or the next day. And so that started me at the Holly plant. I kept my ties with the packing house too, at the Holly plant, well, at age 18 or whatever, well, first year, did whatever they told me to do. Then some guy was working in the office there, he's learning something and so forth. And so he quit or did something different, so I asked for that job, or maybe it was the next year I asked for it, the next season. At that time it was seasonal. And these other guys would go for a nickel more an hour on, maybe they'd drive a forklift. I don't even think there were forklifts or very many of them at that time, but maybe they'd go for a nickel more an hour. And I thought, no, I'm going to go for the long pull and learn this job and try to do better. So that's the route I took. I think my starting pay was $1.25 an hour at that time. That'd been the year 1948. So I couldn't make up my mind. I still went up north in the summertime for the next two or three years. And I think at that time you would be laid off. They were union, but they would run out of olives. Seemed like in April you'd be laid off and would spray the orchards and get a job spraying. I just hated that. You got that stuff all over you, but anyway, at that time there's not much going on. So I don't know when it was, but I think 1951, then the Lindsay Wright payroll job was offered to me, and it paid. Started at $2.25 a month, and I could work an hour and make more than that, and especially during the harvest time. But I took it, and it was supposed to be a 15% bonus with it. And I think after 3 months or 6 months or whatever, then I got a $25 raise, and. So anyway, well, I was fastly starving to death, and I was married and had one child, and so anyway, I stayed until the bonus part came through. Then I told him I couldn't afford to stay at those wages, and so I think I went back and started an hour. 1952, one year I went and worked in the packing house again, and a couple times, once I went and was a foreman trainee in a packing house, and we went to, in the summertime, to a little place called Vineberg, and my wife and her brother had also followed the fruit, and in fact I had seen her at Sebastopol before I ever knew who she was, and she didn't like that kind of life. She didn't like the packing house too well. But anyway, well, our oldest boy was about less than a year old in a stroller, I remember. And I was at this little packing house at Vineberg, which is up by Sonoma, and about 12 or 13 hours a day. And but a chance to learn something. And she didn't like it at all. We almost split up. And so then I decided, well, I'd sever my ties with the packing house and just concentrate on the Holly plant. And so I forget what I did, but anyway, a better job came up while I worked in the lab, and then I think in 1954 I was a sub foreman, and then when I was 1960 I became a foreman over three departments, and it was would be classified as a general foreman. Now they have them that are foreman at over two or three people, but then they only had about four or five foremen in the whole cannery. And so I figured that was going to be my lifelong work, and it didn't stay that way. Well, I kind of goofed it up myself one time with a difference of opinion over something, but then afterwards I went back and then I was on the wrong side of a political. First time I ever saw a political struggle where somebody takes over from somebody else, and they had merged with the cannery in 1966, which was probably about 10% as large as they were, and they loaded the board, and to make a long story short, their ex-general manager in a few years soon became our general manager and knocked people down in the process. First time I'd ever seen it, and hope it's the last. I'm sure it won't be. So, but anyway, well, you were either with them, you could join them if you wanted to, or you could stay with your existing manager. So, anyway, after about 22 years, well, I was looking for a job, so I didn't know what I was going to do. And in fact, I didn't do anything for about five weeks, except look. I figured what I was making at the time, it seemed like it was making $800 and some dollars a month, $829 or something. And but anyway, it seemed like that if you go look for a job, and all I had was a high school education. I'd taken one night class, I think, business administration. And I thought it would be easy to find a job, and really, it wasn't easy at all. I ended up, I think, selling life insurance for a while, and it would have probably worked out all right in the long pull, but at the time, this is the bad bin in 1970, and at the time I had two kids and a wife to support and payments, and I just couldn't make it. And so then when I inspected fruit for federal state inspection that summer, and made good wages for the time, but there you were used and then you were laid off, and at that time, working for the state, you could only, working on that job, you could only work 9 months out of the year, and then you'd have to take 3 months off until you had a regular appointment. It's since changed, but that's the way it was set up at that time, and plus you would be moving. So I didn't stay with that, and I took a job in as a fuel man in a packing house at Lemon Cove, which is about 20 miles from here, and stayed at it 10 months, and at that time they had a few lemons and mostly oranges and some tangerines and so forth, and from that I went into the job that I'm on now for the lemon prorate, and I've been in it for 10 years, and it's a fair job. It's not real high pay, not real low pay, so I'd say middle of the line, and a job that I like very much.
And what do you do exactly?
Our office is in Los Angeles. It's a federal marketing order, that governs the shipments of domestic lemons, which are domestic is in the United States, and regulates the shipments, and the purpose of it is more orderly shipping and also at a better return too. So there's a committee of 12 people represented by growers and handlers that meet in Los Angeles once a week, and that's where our office is, and sets the prorate and carloads for the following week. And so we have a field man. I cover Central California. We have a field man in other areas of Arizona and California, and we're kind of the middleman between our office and the handlers that handle lemons. So, and it's a job whereas I love my job at the olive plant. You were tied down, and it got more and more into double shifts where you were working long hours. I mean, you were required to, not required, but if you did your job, you had to come back to check some on the night shift and so forth. And if you were gone to town, you had to, they had to know how to reach you. And it's kind of like being tied down, even though I live close to work. This job is, you hardly ever see your boss that you work for except two or three times a year, and you've got more freedom than you could ever ask for in most jobs.
When you look back over the period that you lived in California, what would you say was the hardest time for you and your family as far as making ends meet?
You mean as an adult or as a child?
Over your whole lifespan, when do you remember being the hardest time?
I don't think I can really answer you. I don't. I know what you're saying, but I don't recall any specific time when we were small. You know, kids. It was just a way of life. You were poor, and you enjoyed it. I mean, you know, you enjoyed life. You played. You did what you had to do with, and I guess you just accepted that you were poor. Now, I can't really pinpoint any certain area, even as a child or as an adult, that was it really real bad. Now, I remember one thing that where I went to Jefferson School there in Lindsay, and it was grades 1 through 6, and that wanted to go out for basketball, and there was just no way to buy shorts, and I don't know when you had to buy your jerseys and shoes. To do it, it was just out of the question. There just wasn't money for it, and so consequently, I think you lose sometimes when you on things like that because when you if you're active in sports or whatever, especially at an early age, your chances are better to get along with other people, and I got along okay with people anyway, but there just wasn't any. I recall that in the same way on a track meet, there was no money for shorts or whatever.
Okay, we're getting the end of the tape. When you went to school here in Lindsay, especially as a youngster, a lot of the other people that I've interviewed have talked about that they felt they were treated differently because they were migrants from the Midwest. Did you ever have any of that feeling?
Yes, you definitely were. To start with, they call it the X room or the opportunity room. And I remember it was in the third grade. And I found it was much easier for boys than it was for me than it was for my sisters. Because a boy can wear patched jeans or whatever, and now it's in style. At that time it wasn't, and get by with it. And whereas a girl, at that time everybody, all the kids wore dresses, and it's more noticeable, and I always felt that they were more at a disadvantage, a definite disadvantage, more so than I was. About the only thing you had going for you, well, to start back up and start with, in Missouri, it was fashionable to wear lace boots up to your knees, and I think overalls, probably the blue overalls, and even though some kids out here wore them, well, it wasn't that fashionable. And I remember more than once, and even kids that lived by and played with, once in a while they get to teasing you, pick a fight with you, and so forth, over your dress. And it's all I had. I mean, there's no question about changing it, because you had it and you couldn't afford to buy more. But you had trouble with, and I'm sure the girls, it would hurt them more. And then also another fact about being poor, of course at that time there were probably other kids that didn't have baseball mitts, but I remember in the third or fourth grade, well, used to play, one guy would be up and you'd catch flies and you'd get to be up. Well, if I got to be up, I'd give this guy my ups just to use his mitt. You know, is that, so you pay a certain price for being poor.
When you say the external or the opportunities room, were the migrant kids put in one particular room, or what?
I don't think it was all the migrants. I think there's the opportunity room, I think it was the X room, because the opportunity room, if I recall, was later for slower learners. I think you were put in the X room, which is just probably for extra, because I remember at that time there wasn't nearly as many Mexican people as there are now, but there were some Mexicans. In fact, I still see some that I went to from grade 3 on with that still live around here. But about the only thing you had going for you, and I don't think the girls had this going for them, but in Missouri, they teach at a faster rate than they do out here, and or at least they did at that time, and they stick more to basics of the reading, writing, arithmetic. And these people might hate your guts, or these kids, and kids can be cruel. Don't let anybody tell you that they can't, because they can be real, real cruel. And even though a lot of these kids, their parents were from the East, maybe 10 or 20 years prior to that, but then they're natives now, mm-hmm. You know, and they've established themselves and had a steady job and so forth. But anyway, the one thing that you had, that I had going for me was that on spelling, arithmetic, that I don't care whether it was that whole third grade, it wasn't the fourth grade or fifth grade or sixth grade, that they used to have these spelling bees, and the same way the arithmetic bees, and I don't know if these schools still have them or not, but you were one of the first ones, if not the first one chosen, because you could do it and they couldn't. And the same way what it was, they gave you books a lot, and you, I think this is probably in this X room, that you went at your own speed, which I always liked school, and I think from the fourth grade was my first full year here. From the fourth to the eighth, I don't think I missed a day or was tired of a day. And they used to give those little certificates And after that, then I get in junior high school, and your attitude changes, you know. But anyway, so I think if it wasn't for at that time being smarter than some of these other people, they probably killed you. And there's a guy that I think he is dead now, but his name is Mr. Woolsey, Leonard Woolsey. And I saw him afterwards, and after he was a custodian at Jefferson School, and I saw him probably after I'd been out of school 10 or 15 years, and he says, you know, says, they'd have killed you if it hadn't been for me. And so I kind of think it would, because you were something to be laughed at if you come from the East, and you were something different, and probably something that they were a little bit scared of, because it could happen to them. So, and I think that's normal, but, and your ways are different. I remember back East, it was always A and the. Out here it was and the. And the teacher would correct me, and I'd say, no, it's that other way. She said, it's not out here. And then I also remember, and this I think a guy would remember, whatever he was or wherever he was, but they gave a multiple choice quiz, and I think I was in the fourth grade, third or fourth grade. Multiple choice quiz, and you had the A, B, C, or D, and it was how many hours of sleep should an adult be required, and I think I put 8 hours a night. And the question that, and I'm sure this is just the dumbness of a teacher that in correcting the papers, but anyway, it said whatever the initial was, D or B or whatever it was, and she called it, that was correct. And so I went to her and I asked her, I said, well, what was the answer on that? She looked it up and she says, it was 10 hours every day and 10 hours every night. And I said, well, I can't be right. She says, yes, it is. So that's what the book says. And I was still wrong. 8 hours. And so, I mean, this could happen anywhere. And so, but she let me know in short order that was right. That was the way it was. So, and two, I mean, it's a case of an ignorant kid trying to tell a teacher, and so it doesn't. But things like that stick in your mind. But school was a rule, was generally easy for me and enjoyable. We used to walk to school. I remember we lived about 2 miles out, and at one time we rode the bus. I think the buses came into being in somewhere in the, I don't know whether it was the 40s or, it must have been earlier than that, it must have been the 30s, but somewhere in there. But it was just a way of life. It's funny, you get used to whatever you are and whatever the people around you are. And if you don't know any different, you're satisfied. It's I guess as you learn more, then it's when you become more uncomfortable, then you want more. But when you don't have it, you don't miss it. And it's kind of like, oh, you miss some of the things. Kind of like the old saying that people are more religious in poor times than they are in prosperous times, and it's so.
There has been a lot of discussion about the organization of workers during that.
The WPA?
Not necessarily the WPA, but actually labor organizations, mm-hmm. unionizing of the workers during that time. Were you ever involved in any of the labor?
not really. I remember, what was it, 1936, and when the Roosevelt gave people the right to organize, or so, this law, I forget what they call the law. But anyway, it seemed like that maybe in the cities there was more labor movement earlier, but and it seemed like in these fruit towns anyway, it was more, there was no industry at all. And it seemed like it was just more of a survival. I mean, you didn't, people didn't organize as best of my knowledge. And I remember the WPA and stuff like that. But it seemed like the labor movement, it seemed like it must have been in the real early 40s before it started going. I think it would be after 38, 39 where they started some of your defense industries, or even though we weren't at war yet, it started going. Mm-hmm. So,
you mentioned the WPA. What did you ever work on the WPA projects or have any involvement with them?
No, because see, I would be too young. But we have a real picturesque city hall, and at that time, a fire department, a police department, or all built by WPA, had the tile roof and so forth. And there was also, I heard some of the people that after I was an adult talk about working out what they call the Lindsay Ditch prior to the Frank Kern Canal, which runs through here. Then there was a smaller ditch thing that brought water from somewhere. And they worked on that as all cement line, but I remember guys not too, you know, that were adults then that worked on it, and it was they were the lucky ones. I mean, it wasn't a real good pay, but it was considered, I think, a plum if a guy could get a job on it. And at that time, even some of your people that are highly educated weren't making good. And think back at then a lot of these people that were fourth or fifth grade, sixth grade the most education, and old farmer, old farm type, and so forth. And so if they got a job that was steady and a regular income, they were lucky.
It sounds like your family didn't ever live like in the government grower camps or
no.
Anything like that during that time that some people did.
Yeah, some
live in the government camps.
There was one over at Woodville. There was one at, I think they call it Linnell over by Farmersville. But no, I didn't know anything about that. Until other than reading about it and so forth. But it was a case of where government took care of you, I guess, and as first starts. So, but it still, it seemed like the economy as such, looking back on it, it really didn't start to anything change, at least for the better, until Hitler went on the rampage over there and started things clicking, because it created a demand for more goods and so forth. And then also it tended to create knowledge, or people learned more and could build more and so forth. But prior to that, it just seemed like that this country was going down the same road, if not a little faster pace than what it had before. And the New Deal as such may have saved a lot of them, but then it seemed like in those days graft and corruption, and maybe they still are part of everything, but it seemed like everything then was everybody that had any kind of a public office was tainted with graft and payola and so forth. and even more so than I think than it is now.
Do you have something specific in mind when you're talking about that, or you're just talking in general?
Mostly just talking in general, but it seemed like it, well, in case of prostitution or something like that, I mean, they would look the other way to leave a house open, or and it seemed like all your towns were wide open, you know, and even though there would be regulations forbidding it, so it would mean that somebody was, usually the police chief or the sheriff or whatever would be, was probably being paid to see if, and it was something, just trying to think back and hear these people talk, from my dad and other people, is something that even if you agreed or disagreed with it, you didn't say too much. I mean, even if you thought it, you still didn't say too much, because that guy was powerful and he could get you, so to speak. And so they had a lot of, it seemed like police departments and so forth had people in them had a lot of power. Maybe it was just looking at it through the eyes of a kid too, I don't know, but it seemed like that they had more respect, even though they may have been wrong, maybe the right word wouldn't be respect, but they commanded more authority, maybe that was it. And they used that authority. And there was less, there was no, not much regard to people's rights at that time. Now, we may have gone too far the other way at this point, where there's too much regard for the individual rights and not enough common sense in it. But at that time, maybe the right way of saying it would be at that time in Archie or Okie or Missourian, lots of times he didn't have any rights. And the same way back east, this would be similar to it, I guess. I've heard my people say more than once, if a guy was colored, except they said nigger, don't let the sun set on your hair. They meant it. I mean, it wasn't a case of if he did, well, he's in trouble. In this case, if he did, he was either dead or tarred and feathered or something like that. And it was a more of a lawless time, I guess. That's not the right word either. It's more they were, if they thought something was wrong, they dealt with it, and rather severely, I guess.
If I'm understanding you, then you kind of have the impression, maybe you were too young to really have it yourself, but that from your parents you got the idea that being a Missourian or an Oklahoman or from Arkansas, that during that time they had very few rights to much of anything. They pretty much had to do what they were told to do or suffer the consequences.
I think that would be true, and I think it would also be true for the kids in school. I mean, it's the same old story that you're not going to tolerate from this hokey kid what you're going to tolerate from somebody that may be your neighbor, mm-hmm. And it's just, to a certain extent, it's true now whether you're talking about the Mexicans or whatever. So, but at the same time, whether you were still in Missouri or out here, I think people's individual rights, lots of times you didn't have any. Maybe just the times that they lived in, because everybody was hurting for money. Everything was, and I remember it was a way of life there for people to make their own whiskey back east. And it was a way of life to, I think the country was dry then, to bootleg it. And so they caught some of them. They caught probably 5% of them, and 95% of them they didn't. Every once in a while somebody would get killed on poison whiskey or something, and that would be it. So But I think partly a lot of it was just the times that we lived in, whether you were there or here.
I've heard mention of families. Well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that the statistic that I've read was that many of the migrants were only able to find work about 50% of the year. And I'm wondering if your dad, or it would have been mostly your father during the really height of the mm-hmm. of the bad hard times, was he generally able to find something, or did he spend a lot of time that he was not able to find work?
Yes, it seemed like he would usually try to find work, and maybe there'd be some time off in between, but I can't really recall. But I do know at that time versus now. Now the citrus that's around here is spread throughout the year. Now the summer is maybe the real slow part, but at least there's something going on. At that time, and even up through the early 1950s, the navel season, which is our big orange season here, was over usually the first week in January. And the Valencia season didn't start till about the first part of May, and it lasted about 5 weeks. After that, they were through. I mean, everybody was through. You did something else. And that has since changed. So possibly at that time, what you're saying is true. And of course, that may have been the time that where he was out cutting wood too,
mm-hmm.
and stuff. But I do know it was a struggle just to put beans and potatoes on the table, and it seemed like ammunition must have been cheap, because every family had a rifle or a shotgun, and I know my dad would go out, and we usually lived, there'd be a dirt road through the orange grove, and jackrabbits were plentiful. I wouldn't eat one now, but we ate lots and lots of jackrabbits. I mean, you learned what to look for and what to not look for in them, if they're healthy or unhealthy, and they were good.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same old story. If you're used to that, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, they were doggone good.
I think too, it's a commentary on the times. You know, if it's choosing between starving and eating a jackrabbit,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's much of a choice.
No, there wouldn't be. But there, it was just accepted. This, of course, we were used to eating rabbits. And I remember back east we ate possum. I can still remember how slick possum and sweet potatoes. And possum is one of the worst scavengers of all animals.
That's kind of a greasy.
Uh-huh.
Animals.
Oh, they're an ugly animal. But anyway, it's just a way of life. Now, another thing, the expression that you hear a lot is grits, and I still don't know what grits are. I mean, I think it must have come from further back east, you know, in Kentucky and places like that. But you hear those expressions, and most all that stuff, if you're going through it, it doesn't have any meaning until after you get a few years on you and then look back.
Yeah. Do you remember or ever heard your dad talk about the way that the growers treated their workers, how that was at that time? And then some of the people that I've interviewed have said that you had to watch them every minute because they would cheat you, and others say we were treated like a part of the family. It was not like that at all.
I think there was a lot of instances where they were, but I think from my brother, when he came out here, was in his junior year of high school, and he never ever finished. Consequently, he's done quite a bit better than I've done. But anyway, so he went to work, and at that time, he picked fruit with my dad. And I think their relationships were good to excellent.
With the grower.
With the grower. They usually worked for a contractor. I still remember his name. He's Ray Sotella.
Ray Sotella?
Uh-huh. And was a nice-looking Mexican contractor, dressed nice and so forth. And I think that even though they were picking fruit, they were picking in their own area, so to speak, and working under the contractor. And as far as I know, for the times, they were treated real good. I mean, are good. I think where so many of these people run into these other problems, where there would be migrant from Lindsay to, they'd go to work the cherries or the apricots. There used to be a lot of apricots or pears and so forth around San Jose and Santa Clara. And a lot of people used to go from here to there and then on to the apples. And so I think a lot of it was where they would go from out of their territory, so to speak. And then not only are you a fruit picker, you're really unwanted. You don't do anything for a town. You don't, let's face it, if you're a fruit picker and go to a town, you don't help the climate of that town any with your appearance. And they even though they need you, it's kind of like us needing the Mexican Nationals, people resent you. I think there were a lot of dishonest roars, but as far as knowing any, I don't. But just from hearing people talk. And a penny then was worth quite a bit, you know. Now it's a penny. Kids won't even stoop over to pick up a 10-cent pop bottle. Makes me mad. But I think, yeah, that there were some of them were cheated. And I do know that it's just a way of life that they wanted a full day's work, and they wanted, there was no, lots of times I don't even think of a rest period, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but it was all part of the times.
Speaking of the times, there was quite a furor that came up when Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath was published during that time. What was your opinion of that book?
Well, I didn't really know too much about it until I saw the movie in, what was it, 40-something or other. Anyway, after it had been out. But the people that I've heard comment on it that are from the East have said, other than the sex part of it and so forth, and that may have been true or not, but I think probably part of that was added to it, and I can't even recall all of it. But as far as the people commenting on it, most of them said it was pretty true to life. It was a way of life. And if I remember right there, in this, the people, these Okies, didn't really have any rights either, did they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that was a way of life. See, back, this is another thing. If you stay in your natural habitat, or Missouri or whatever state you're from, you may not be the Mr. Rich of the town, or you may not be the Mr. Poor, but you may be the middle class of that town, or maybe down here in part of it, and socially acceptable. You leave that, and doggone it, you're not acceptable. I mean, you're at the bottom of the heap again. And like I say, even if they want you, need you, you're not really wanted. So sometimes I think people look at it as a threat to their own way of life. And especially, something I noticed was the people, I think I touched on this earlier, that were transplants from Missouri or there, they come to Mr. So-and-so of Lindsay or Porterville or wherever they're from, and they forget their own background.
Where they came from originally, huh? We're getting the end of the tape thing. This is the second interview with Mr. Earl Butler. The interview was done on March the 7th, 1981, at Lindsay, California, by Judith Gannon for the California Odyssey Project, Cal State Bakersfield. Okay, Mr. Butler, I was listening to the tapes on the way down here, and at one point you commented that your father really had a distaste for Roosevelt and that there were other people that felt like that. Could you tell me a little bit more about what it was that they objected to in Roosevelt's policies?
All I remember is that prior to the incident of the cattle, whether they had to kill the cattle, or whatever it was, I think part of it was just to stabilize the market, so to speak. And according to one of my sisters I talked to afterwards, well, she said no, said she didn't think the cattle were diseased, that it was just a matter of the government decided to eliminate so many, and. She didn't think that they even paid for the killing of them. I mean, so you were, I don't know what the number was, but if he, prior to that, I don't know whether he was for or against Roosevelt, but I do know after that he hated him with a passion, and Roosevelt took credit for so many things that didn't, in his estimation and in mine, looking back at it since, that he didn't really deserve the credit for.
Like what, and for example?
He took credit for straightening the economy out and so forth, and people were living a better life and so forth. But actually, this didn't really happen until the wartime, and so. But it, and I guess just in general, his whole policy after that, I don't think there's very much about him that we did like. So, but I, like I say, I was young, but looking back at it, I almost feel the same way too, which I guess is normal.
Yeah, it's, so what you're saying is that it really was the war that caused the economy to take an upturn.
To create a better life. Now, I agree that in 36, 37, when some of the laws were enacted, that Social Security and stuff like that, and the advent of cooperatives and protection for them, turned out to be good. So I can't say it was all bad. But he was known as the savior of everything, and Republicans blame the Democrats for ever getting there in the first place.
Yeah, Hoover really was the one that
he was a fall. He was a fall guy.
He really got.
I don't guess he had any personality either, though. So.
As I was listening to the tapes, the part that we sort of skipped over last time was your meeting your wife in Sebastopol and your subsequent marriage. Could you tell me a little bit about how you met her?
I think I met her. I don't know. She was from Exeter, and I don't know whether I met her here or there, but anyways, right after I got out of high school. I think I met her before I got out of high school. She had gone up there with her brother and his wife, her and her sister, to work. So I guess I probably met her there, and then worked with her here, and not really too much to tell. We just knew each other, and you know how you are. Didn't do anything for a long time, and finally decided that was the direction you wanted to go, you know.
When were you married?
I was married when I was 20 in 1949. And I have two children, and it worked out pretty good. I mean, she's a good woman. So I'd say probably it's my fault that we didn't stay married. And what I'd say, well, most of it would be my fault. So sometimes the grass looks greener on the other side. When you get there, it's not green at all. So, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. But
you
that's
have a, two children then.
Two children.
Mm-hmm. And do your children live around here, or are they?
One lives in between Porterville and Terrabella. The other one lives on the East Coast in Savage, Maryland.
Oh, Maryland's a beautiful state.
Well, he doesn't think he'd like to be back out here. In fact, he's on his job. He's going to Australia this summer, so we'll be over there for 6 months. He works for RCA, so.
The kids went to school out here in Lindsay?
Both of them graduated from Lindsay High School, and the youngest one that works for Tulare County now, he didn't go to college. The other one went to, well, he almost had his AA degree at COS and quit in May to go to the service. So I think he's going back, he is back in school now. This is the second semester, and probably will be able to pick up AA this time. Whether he'll ever make it the other way or not, I don't know. I hope so. Mm-hmm. That's a long way, especially when you get older.
As you get older, and if you're trying to work and go to school, mm-hmm. that's a tough way to go. So, your mother, is she still living in this area? Or
no, my mother died in 1957, and my father died, I think, in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, you asked that. I was thinking about that, something like that yesterday myself, about, like, I was 27 when my mother died, and like you almost feel like you're, even though you're pretty good age, you feel like you were a little bit cheated because your grandkids don't have time to get up and know their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so one of the few advantages, I guess, to having your children at a younger age. But back to my wife, she's since remarried, and the relationship seems to be good. Mm-hmm. And I see her. In fact, she still works here in Lindsay, so I meet her on the road and wave and stuff like that. And it isn't the same. If I had it to do over again, I'm sure I wouldn't go that route. But because once you split a family up, my relationship and her relationship with the kids is good, but it's still a lot different. I mean, a lot lacking. And just my son from the East is coming in April. Well, he stays at his mother's and he sees me and vice versa, you know. And so he's going to have to store some of his all his furniture while he's gone. So it will probably be stored there, you know. Whereas if you were a family, even if you had every room full, you would make room for it. Mm-hmm. So in a way, when you divorce, regardless of the reasons, looking at it afterwards, you really cheating your kids and your grandkids, and probably yourself.
Yeah, I would say so. when were you and your wife divorced?
Well, let's see, I paid 89 months rent here. So,
it's been 89 months, huh?
So it would be about 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Your kids were then quite older.
Let's see, I guess it'd probably be 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were grown. So, but still is a, guys are foolish sometimes. Mm-hmm.
When you look back over your youth in particular, I know you talked about in school that being poor was, that kids were sometimes cruel. I wonder if you ever heard your parents talk about, or your mother talk about, feeling that the local people were hostile toward the people who migrated here from, like Missouri or Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
I'm sure that they were, and I can't recall specifically anything, but I'm sure there's a tendency to protect what you've got, and people that are here, they've got something, and here's an outsider, outsiders coming in by the drove, so to speak, and it's bound to change that way of life. So I'm sure that there was a lot of hostility. Now, another thing, where we used to go up to Sebastopol or what to consider fruit tramping and work in the summertime. Even though those people needed you to work, they were still kind of hostile toward you because you were a different breed, mm-hmm. so to speak. You might be the same as what they were, but you're moving around, you know. And in answer to your question, I'm sure that there was, mm-hmm. was a lot of hostility.
Do you, you didn't really follow the crops, though. You went to Sebastopol to work some of this, but came back here and pretty much settled in Lindsay and stayed with the packing houses and things here.
Yeah, I worked at Dolly plant and packing mm-hmm. houses and other jobs, anything to keep going.
Do you remember or recall your family ever, I know you said as you left Missouri you got canned goods and things like that from mm-hmm. the government. Do you ever remember any other times during the time that you were here in Lindsay that you were either recipients of commodities or any of the government programs that were supposed to be helping the migrants then?
I'm sure that probably we were at different times. I remember, it seemed like I remember at Christmas time one time we got a bag of groceries or something, but that would be from a church group or mm-hmm. something like that. And so probably we were, but I can't recall very much of it because at that time it was the WPA and it was pretty active here, but I think that was, if a guy was lucky enough to be on the WPA during that time, he's considered like having a steady job now.
Uh-huh.
And so they were a little higher class of people. Excuse me.
I have talked to some people that have very vivid memories of having stood in line for various commodities that were being given by the government. Do you remember any incidents like that when you were coming up?
It seems like I do, but I can't really relate to them.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that we just had almost zero money. When we first came out here, we had orange boxes for chairs and I don't know where the table came from, but we had a table and we had beds, such as they were. And I remember how proud my mother was whenever she ordered six chairs at $2 a piece. I mean, they were the proudest thing, mm-hmm. proudest thing of all. And such stuff as that, but other than that, I don't. I think talking to earlier to you that you asked me why so many people came out here in the early 30s. This is from also talk to my sister, who talked to my aunt, who lives here in town and came out here earlier. Said that in the late 20s, everybody that came out here, the work was extra plentiful. I mean, there was work for everyone. And then I guess when the crash came and it changed things around, well, then it completely changed the complexion of things. So that could answer a question as to why so many people may have come out here in the 30s, because she said in the late 20s, when my folks were first out here, said that there was just work galore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it changed around. Of course, the economy changed
yeah.
around, too. I mean, it was in a terrific heyday. And so I guess, but I do remember back east there that California was a golden, the land of opportunity.
Do you remember your parents ever talking about seeing flyers and things the second time they came out, advertising for field workers and anything like that? A number of people have mentioned that.
I think I remember. I think that that there was advertisements and promises. It seemed like during that period of time that there was all kinds of ruses or whatever you would call them, or cruel jokes or something, to get people to, it would really build something up as an opportunity for work and so forth. When you got there, it would be nothing, or else it would be real cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I do recall some of that. In fact, I think it was quite a bit of it.
As you came in the late 30s to, if I remember,
37,
and at that time there were lots and lots of people coming in, and some people have spoken about inspections at the borders and problems getting across the California border. Do you recollect, as you came across the border, that you had to go through a strict inspection or had any trouble getting into California that time?
I think no more than, maybe a little bit more than what you would have now. I think we had some apples, they confiscated those. It seemed like you had to open up some of your luggage, but as far as I can remember, it was conducted very well,
mm-hmm.
and there was no bitterness or whatever against us. And I think we only had 9 people in that car and a cat, so they're going to get mad at somebody. They should have got mad at us.
Yeah, I remember a couple of incidents where people had to take their car apart and they were inspected just, for bed bugs and head lice and a very demeaning kind of search that went on. But sounds like,
Well, like I say, I was young and 8. I can't recall all of that stuff. But as far as I remember, people talking about what you just said about lice and fleas and so forth, and just like as if they were animals. But I don't think it happened to us. I do remember that something. Well, I've even forgotten it too. But I. You think of cotton being grown in the East. Well, in Missouri, there was never any cotton. So we came, I guess it's probably in Arizona, or anyway, right by the border. And I said something about, what was, my twin sister and I were talking, and somebody said, what was that? And I said, well, green beans or something, and she said something else, but I forgot the punchline to it. Anyway, neither one of us were right. It was cotton. We never had ever seen it before.
Oh, you were looking at the crops and trying.
Uh huh. Yeah, it's cotton up about. Anyway, most of the time, especially people from Oklahoma and Texas, they had cotton. But as far as I know, we had none in Missouri. So.
Your father went back to Missouri when he and your mother separated,
mm-hmm.
And that was
1944, I believe. I was 43, I think, or 44. I was 14.
How did his life go for him? Did he? Do you think, as you look back on it, that had he stayed here, that things would have been better for him, or did it work out for him to go back to? Missouri?
Probably for him, there's always 6 of one, a half dozen of another. I mean, I'd say his life wasn't all bad by going back there. He did remarry. In fact, his wife died and he remarried again. And I never went back there until he died. I'd write back and forth, but it was always some of rest of my family or kids, brother and sisters had been back there and visited. So he was living back to the Missouri way of life, and of course he was older then, but I'd say he pretty well enjoyed life. And people back there are to me, at least when I was back there in 1965, were still different. And I have always heard the expression, those dumb Missourians or those dumb Arkies or dumb so-and-so Okies. When we're back there for my dad's funeral, and I thought to myself, sometimes I think that they've got that thing reversed. They ought to be saying those, feel sorry for those Californians, because it's a different way of life still back there, at least in the smaller towns. And I've heard my wife, we've had company, and I've heard her say, well, stay for dinner, when really I knew she didn't really want to fix dinner for someone. But back then, when they say stay for dinner, they mean stay for dinner. I mean, they don't mean maybe about it. They want you to stay. And they're probably they're more direct, it's a lot slower paced, and probably a lot more honest than we are sometimes here.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people look back at more country, slower life, mm-hmm. as being a better way to go. Although here in Lindsay, I would think that it's a small enough town that...
No, it's a slower way of life, yeah. than Bakersfield or Los Angeles by far, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we noticed that moving to Bakersfield from LA.
Oh yeah, it's different. The more population, the more cars and more people, the more of everything you've got too, usually. So.
Do you ever remember being, you mentioned dumb Missourian or Okie or what have you. Do you ever remember in your growing up years or your young adulthood having anybody call you that or?
You know, I'm sure in grade school, yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially when I wore those, all I had was those high boots that come clear to your knee and those overalls. So I'm sure that they did. In fact, I probably would now too.
As you look back over this whole experience of having come out here as a youngster and lived through the Depression here and those years of hard times, do you think that it had any, that experience had any lasting effect on your personality as it is today?
Yes, I'm sure it did. In fact, since I talked to you before, I thought about it. I think I told you over the phone that two things I like now is I like to have money in my billfold, and I don't mean $50, I mean $200 or $300 or more. I like to have, I still remember the one light, 40-watt light in the bedroom, and all those kids crowded in there trying to read or to do her homework. So I like plenty of light and that. And in all honesty, I think probably, even though sometimes you don't feel this directly, I think maybe it might give you an inferiority complex of some sort. I don't know.
Talk a little bit more about that.
I don't really know. I mean, I just thinking about it. I don't feel inferior, but sometimes I think it probably, if it doesn't, I think it probably gives you a leaning toward it. I don't really know, Judy.
Is it, you mean like not being a little bit different than the rest of the people, particularly as a kid, makes you a little less self-confident as an adult? Yeah.
Sometimes, or maybe that you just don't have as much polish or something, finesse or whatever the right word would be, mm-hmm. as you would have otherwise, because I think it's like sports or something like that. You start at a younger age, you've learned the basics earlier, and then all of a sudden, well, whereas if you didn't start, well, you learned it 2 or 3 years later, you're just that much further behind. Mm-hmm. And so I think more in relation to that. And like I say, I'm not even sure that statement is the truth, but I'm just trying to think of it. And And so I think it would be more in the line of what I call polish or presenting yourself or something like that.
Sort of like it's hard to get rid of the image of being sort of a country hillbilly type of person. Is that?
Well, not so much that. I can't really pinpoint. I mean, I sometimes I put, maybe this would be the best way to put it, that I think had you not been poor, you would probably, maybe I couldn't present myself anyway, but I think you'd probably present yourself, you'd be a looser acting person and present yourself better than you would otherwise.
See. You know, after I talked with you the last time, I interviewed another fellow, and he was talking about, this is really changing the subject, but he was talking about this business of setting the rates that you're involved in with a lot of hostility. He's still in the fruit picking, the citrus end of it, and saying that kind of regulation was still making it tough for the fruit people, the people, the workers in the field.
Well, you mean the type of work that I do now?
Yeah, having federal
marketing orders.
Yeah, because it cuts down the amount of work, because at a certain point there's a cutoff point and you can't ship any more fruit, so that no more is picked and the workers are then not able to work
work full time.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, we'll back up a little bit and going back to the 30s and also lasted up to the 50s, I guess. That
before you get started, we're just about at the end of this.
Okay.
So let me. Okay, Mr. Butler, we were going to talk about the quotas of the. I'm not even sure.
Fruit
that you can only ship so much.
Well, what this man that picks fruit was referring to, I'm sure, was that prior to the 50s, the naval orange season, which is the main season here, there's navels and lenches. The lenches start usually in May, but April or May, but the naval season used to start about Armistice Day and would be over, usually completely over, by the first week in January. But at that time, you had probably half as much acreage as you've got now. And this is what this person doesn't seem to realize. Okay, after that, or even before that time, you had more plantings and more plantings. The market couldn't absorb it, so the season stretched out. And so, sure, it's restrictive marketing, but if you put all of that on the market at one time, or if he would pick all of it at one time, so he would stay busy, the market could not absorb it, and because they've tried it, and it will not absorb it. And consequently, it drives prices down to the fact where instead of brokers or buyers buying FOB, the packing house, all they're doing is waiting for the price to go down even more, and it's what the packing house will send fruit rolling to an auction, and they'll pick it up along the way without having to pay the freight on it. And the person is looking at it from his own standpoint of working. Mm-hmm. Working every day of the week, but most houses do work every day of the week, barring rain and so forth. But I'm sure that's what he was referring to, that instead of probably he was referring to that along with something else too, that they don't go into a grove and pick the entire grove before they finish. They may go in and if you had a grove and I had a grove, and whether it be a co-op house or an independent house, well, probably they're going to pick 10% of my crop or 30% and the same percentage of your total crop. And so they will move in and pick that amount and then go to a different place. But so I'm sure that he's looking at his own thing, but what he isn't saying is that when they did work that period of time, then what did he do when he got through in the first week of January? I remember one year I worked in the packing house, and then I went and pruned grapes for my brother-in-law afterwards. It was a lesser pay, but it was a job. And but you during this area and during that time, there was a period between January, February, March, and it was usually into April before there's any spraying to be done. So I think this guy is, he may have thinned plums in April, but, and he may have pruned during the winter, but so sometimes when he's saying it, he's not taking in the whole account, because if you talk to him again, you might ask him what he did and what did most people do during that period of time, because I remember there was a lot of people out of work.
During those 4 months before before the
yeah. And even when the olive plant, and it was much more stable than the packing houses, but when they would close down like that, when I was first married, I'd have to go out and spray. I think I mentioned it before, and I just hated to spray.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the only job that around at that time there was not really much going on.
So what you're saying is that the change is that there's the periods are shorter, like maybe you won't work one day in the week so that you don't get so many oranges on the market, whereas in the past they would pick everything, but then there'd be a 4 month period that there would be practically nothing to do. So now if people can't work one day a week, but at least it sort of spreads the season over a longer period of time.
Well, actually, I think probably the season is spread over a longer period of time, because it may be, as an example, the orange season was the biggest one in history. I mean, it's 80,000 cars, and largest before has been 60, and before that was 50 or something. So, I think they're 35 or 40% picked at this time, okay? But they may have moved more fruit during this period of time than the total of that total crop at the time he was talking about. So what he's saying is really not so, and I'm sure that he had time off the other way too, and he's just kind of forgotten it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you tend to forget sometimes, but what he's saying is to a certain amount right, that it is, they have a quota that they can ship, and consequently they pick to that quota, and there may be some downtime. But most of the time, it's a matter of people leveling off their crews and so forth, and to maintain, they know what their quota is going to be, and they try to keep those same people busy.
Mm-hmm. When did this system come into being?
The federal marketing order?
Yeah.
I think the machinery was set up for federal marketing orders in 1936 and 37. This is one of the things I believe that probably in 37. And the order I worked for, the Lemon Administrative Committee, was put into effect in 1943, I believe. The Naval and Valencia Order, I don't know if they were put in prior to that time or later, but I would say if anything at the same time or prior,
mm-hmm.
because there was more oranges than there are lemons. It's been controversial. I mean, some people like it and some people don't, but it has some of the opponents of it say that all it does, it protects the guy that and brings the price up and actually causes more overplanting because the price is good, and then you would have the other way. But I don't really know. I do know that when you don't have any a form of orderly marketing, you can have the most honest handlers in the world go to church on Sunday, but if they tell you they're going to ship 20 carloads, and the next guy says he's going to ship 20, and you turn them loose, they will ship 30 or 40, and consequently you will demoralize the market. And contrary to what most people believe, if you do put an oversupply of fruit into the market, into an area, it takes about 4 weeks to stabilize that again. And so there's more to it than just setting quotas and so forth. I mean, it seems to be an equitable way, and yet the opponents of it say sometimes it isn't equitable. But usually the ones that are talking about being able to ship more, or in this picker's case of being able to pick more, they're talking about if they were allowed to do it, and Judy Gannon and everybody else couldn't. Well, sure, you can, if everyone else has got a lid on them or quota, and you can shoot your pump your stuff on the market wide open, sure, you can sell it. But it works the other way around when everybody's turned loose and everybody's going in there with a hard lick onto the marketplace. The prices, all they got to do is just wait for you. Mm-hmm. Because...
is the citrus the only one that has these kinds of quotas, or are there throughout the various produce houses in California, there are other... For carrots and whatever else they raise, tomatoes and that, is that same kind of a...
Some aren't as extensive, and some are relate to quality or instead of quantity, and some aren't what classified as a full marketing order. There might, I forget what the proper classification for them is, but the ones I do know about, Olive Administrative Committee has a federal marketing order. It works a little different from what we do. The tree fruit, which is your peaches, plums, and so forth, worked under a tree fruit agreement, which is a form of a marketing order. And they work theirs a little bit differently, that they restrict they'll actually eliminate some of the smaller sizes on a big crop year. And they all work for the same common goal, for orderly marketing, and then I guess also the best returns to the grower too. But oranges and lemons are both under orders. Olives are since 1966, and grapefruit have been, and I'm sure, I don't know about the vegetables, but the milk is under some kind of an order, so I think you would find it several throughout the country.
Sounds like lots of things there. Speaking of growers, that reminds me, you worked only part of the time in field work and picking fruit and that kind of thing, and I wondered if you felt that the growers treated their workers fairly fair, or whether you really had to keep a close eye on them to keep them from taking advantage.
Well, I didn't pick fruit other than when I went to high school. I picked plums a little bit, and I picked oranges a little bit, as anything to work at. But back to the times that you're talking of, I don't recall. I mean, I recall hearing people talk about it, but I don't recall it happening in our family.
Mm-hmm.
That I think the use was was probably were probably treated good is you got to remember that back then that this whole concept that we know of as a way of life was completely different then. I mean, everything was different from what it is now, and what you might think of as way out of the ordinary was now would be completely like your neighbor at that time or ordinary. But in answer to your question, no, I as far as I know, they were treated fairly.
Did any of your family members ever follow the crops, or did work primarily and stay in field work or packing housework?
My brother did, who's 8 years, seven, a little over 7 years older than I am. He went into Medford, Oregon, and places like that, and then came back and was a packing house foreman and then a manager, and he's got his own ranch out here now, and they stayed with it for a few years, but then all of this changed too, as this, what we were talking about prior or just a few minutes ago about in the 50s, whenever the season started stretching out longer and longer. Before, there was a need for seasonal help that you could use right now, a fast, short season, and turn them loose so you didn't have the overhead and so forth. So a lot of people, a lot of packing houses contracted Betts Packing, which was based somewhere in the South. But anyway, they actually used their fruit tramps, so to speak, and they went from the oranges to the apples to the pears to the, and it ran the jobs, and it complete with the foreman and furnished the crews, and plus they used some local people. But, and this is the time I remember was during the war and the, after that, when wages weren't that good and help was hard to get and so forth. So they created, there was a vacuum there, and they filled that vacuum. Okay, and then whenever the oranges in particular started stretching out to where they were full year-round job, then there was no longer the demand for that seasonal help. You wanted to take somebody that was going to work for you full-time. And it's the same old concept that if they're working for you, they're going to be better help for you as a rule than they are if they're working for somebody else and just contracting their labor out to you. So it changed the whole way of doing things. And now the picking, it may not have changed that. Well, I'm sure it would change that too, because there would be work available here, whereas before, to get to work, you would have to go from here to whatever the next crop was. So, and this came about, I would say, in the early 50s, and started changing, just from the standpoint of more and more citrus being planted.
I think that pretty much answers the questions or what I had wanted to cover in the two interviews. Between the time that I first saw you and today, did you have any recollections or any thoughts that you wanted to share with me that I haven't covered?
Just the two that I was thinking about the light bulbs and money, and I got an aunt that lives here in Lindsay, and my sister was talking to her, and she said, well, I could sure tell her a lot of things, and she's I forget what year they came out here, but that she would be more familiar with it than I would be.
Why don't you give me her name, and I'll get in touch with her, and maybe she'd be willing to talk with
me. We could call her from right here if you wanted.
Okay.
After
well, thank
interview.
You for your time, Mr. Butler. Let's turn off the machine here.
Well, thank you.